huge amounts of heat, 100 million degrees or more, enough to begin to generate the heavier elements in a process known as nucleosynthesis. In 1957, working with others, Hoyle showed how the heavier elements were formed in supernova explosions. For this work, W.A. Fowler, one of his collaborators, received a Nobel Prize. Hoyle, shamefully, did not. According to Hoyle's theory, an exploding star would generate enough heat to create all the new elements and spray them into the cosmos, where they would form gaseous clouds, the interstellar medium, as it is known, that could eventually coalesce into new solar systems. With the new theories, it became possible at last to construct plausible scenarios for how we got here. What we now think we know is this. About 4.6 billion years ago, a great swirl of gas and dust, some 15 billion miles across, accumulated in space where we are now and began to aggregate. Virtually all of it, 99.9% of the mass of the solar system, went to make the sun. Out of the floating material that was left over, two microscopic grains floated close enough together to be joined by electrostatic forces. This was the moment of conception for our planet. All over the inchoate solar system, the same was happening. Colliding dust grains formed larger and larger clumps. Eventually, the clumps grew large enough to be called planetesimals. As these endlessly bumped and collided, they fractured or split or recombined in endless random permutations. But in every encounter, there was a winner, and some of the winners grew big enough to dominate the orbit around which they traveled. It all happened remarkably quickly. To grow from a tiny cluster of grains to a baby planet, some hundreds of miles across, is thought to have taken only a few tens of thousands of years. In just 200 million years, possibly less, the Earth was essentially formed, though still molten and subject to constant bombardment from all the debris that remained floating about. At this point, about 4.5 billion years ago, an object the size of Mars crashed into Earth, blowing out enough material to form a companion sphere, the Moon. Within weeks, it is thought, the flung material had reassembled itself into a single clump, and within a year it had formed into the spherical rock that companions us yet. Most of the lunar material, it is thought, came from the Earth's crust, not its core, which is why the Moon has so little iron, while we have a lot. The theory, incidentally, is almost always presented as a recent one, but in fact it was first proposed in the 1940s by Reginald Daly of Harvard. The only recent thing about it is people paying any attention to it. When Earth was only about a third of its eventual size, it was probably already beginning to form an atmosphere, mostly of carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane, and sulfur. Hardly the sort of stuff that we would associate with life, and yet from this noxious stew, life formed. Carbon dioxide is a powerful greenhouse gas. This was a good thing because the sun was significantly dimmer back then. Had we not had the benefit of a greenhouse effect, the Earth might well have frozen over permanently, and life might never have gotten a toehold. But somehow, life did. For the next 500 million years, the young Earth continued to be pelted relentlessly by comets, meteorites, and other galactic debris, which brought water to fill the oceans and the components necessary for the successful formation of life. It was a singularly hostile environment, and yet somehow life got going. Some tiny bag of chemicals twitched and became animate. We were on our way. 4 billion years later, people began to wonder how it had all happened, and it is there that our story next takes us. Part 2. The Size of the Earth. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Alexander Pope. 4. The Measure of Things. If you had to select the least convivial scientific field trip of all time, you could certainly do worse than the French Royal Academy of Sciences' Peruvian expedition of 1735. Led by a hydrologist named Pierre Bouguer and a soldier mathematician named Charles-Marie de la Condamine, it was a party of scientists and adventurers who traveled to Peru with the purpose of triangulating distances through the Andes. At the time, people had lately become infected with a powerful desire to understand the Earth, to determine how old it was, and how massive, where it hung in space, and how it had come to be. The French party's goal was to help settle the question of the circumference of the planet by measuring the length of 1 degree of meridian, or 1/360th of the distance around the planet, along a line reaching from Yaroqui, near Quito, to just beyond Cuenca, in what is now Ecuador, a distance of about 200 miles. Triangulation, their chosen method, was a popular technique based on the geometric fact that if you know the length of one side of a triangle and the angles of two corners, you can work out all its other dimensions without leaving your chair. Suppose, by way of example, that you and I decided we wished to know how far it is to the moon. Using triangulation, the first thing we must do is to put some distance between us. So let us say for argument that you stay in Paris and I go to Moscow, and we both look at the moon at the same time. Now, if you imagine a line connecting the three principles of this exercise, that is, you and I and the moon, it forms a triangle. Measure the length of the baseline between you and me and the angles of our two corners, and the rest can be simply calculated. Because the interior angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees, if you know the sum of two of the angles, you can instantly calculate the third, and knowing the precise shape of a triangle and the length of one side tells you the length of the other sides. This was, in fact, the method used by a Greek astronomer, Hipparchus of Nicaea, in 150 BC to work out the moon's distance from Earth. At ground level, the principles of triangulation are the same, except that the triangles don't reach into space, but rather are laid side to side on a map. In measuring a degree of meridian, the surveyors would create a sort of chain of triangles marching across the landscape. Almost at once, things began to go wrong. Sometimes spectacularly so. In Quito, the visitors somehow provoked the locals and were chased out of town by a mob armed with stones. Soon after, the expedition's doctor was murdered in a misunderstanding over a woman. The botanist became deranged. Others died of fevers and falls. The third most senior member of the party, a man named Pierre Godin, ran off with a 13-year-old girl and could not be induced to return. At one point, the group had to suspend work for 8 months, while La Condamine rode off to Lima to sort out a problem with their permits. Eventually, he and Bouguer stopped speaking and refused